Today at Reader's Corner, Sally Bedell Smith, author of Prince Charles, The Passions and Paradoxes of an Improbable Life. I'm Bob Custer. Welcome to Reader's Corner. Our country was founded on the very idea that a free people should not be ruled by kings and queens. That said, there's an undeniable and lasting allure associated with monarchies, and that's particularly true when it comes to Great Britain. One of the most mysterious and arguably most misunderstood members of the British royal family is Prince Charles, the man next in line to become the King of England. He's the subject of Sally Bedell Smith's New York Times bestseller titled Prince Charles, The Passions and Paradoxes of an Improbable Life. It's now out in paperback. I had the pleasure of introducing Sally at the 2017 Sun Valley Writers Conference, where she spoke about her biography of Charles and her earlier bestseller, Elizabeth the Queen. Sally is a longtime journalist and a contributing editor at Vanity Fair, but she is best known as an extraordinary biographer. In addition to her books about Prince Charles and Queen Elizabeth II, she has written best-selling profiles of Diana, Princess of Wales, Bill and Hillary Clinton, and John and Jacqueline Kennedy, among others. With her latest book, Sally once again reminds us of the power of personal stories to inspire and to shape how we view each other and the world. She joins us by phone for this interview. Sally Bedell Smith, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Thank you. It's wonderful to be talking to you, Bob.
Well, Sally, let's start with your incredible background. How does an American journalist turned author gain the trust and confidence of the royals in writing these biographies? It just and I remember reading something when I introduced you in Sun Valley. I read something about a cocktail party you were at and how close you were to the royals and how close you were to the people who surrounded the royals. And I just think it's fascinating that an American manages to get on the inside. How's this happen?
Oh, well, part of it is serendipity. Part of it is the fact that I have been for many decades a sort of dyed-in-the-wool Anglophile, and as a consequence developed and made a lot of friends in the UK, really starting in the early 1980s. And a number of those friends also happened to be friends and in some cases relatives of in the royal family. And when I was asked 2 days after Diana's death in 1997 to write her biography, I went over there immediately and got in touch with all the people I knew who knew them and said, I want to write an honest biography of her. And I have to write it a little faster than the last two, which each took 5 years, and had to finish this one working at warp speed. But I think the fundamental answer to the question, there's no secret sauce. It's really just being honest and straightforward and just saying, all I want to do is understand and explain these people who are kind of in a separate world, in a bubble, as it were. And in the case of Diana, I just was able to talk to a lot of people who knew them both. And I found myself writing what was really kind of almost a psychological analysis of her, because I had no idea, even though I had met each of them. That was kind of a crucial thing. I had met each of them very informally, very serendipitously. In his case, back in 1991, when he was a spectator at a polo match and I was with a group of friends, and he saw somebody in our group who was a great friend of his beloved grandmother, the Queen Mother. And what struck me at the time was that he was so warm and informal and solicitous to this woman who was, he was at 42 and I think she was 74. And he was just 180 degrees different from the way he was being portrayed in the tabloid press at the time. And then I met the Queen in 2007, also at a, you know, at a social occasion, and my husband rather impudently asked her if she'd bet on the Kentucky Derby, which she had attended for the first time. But she wasn't fazed by that, and she sort of twigged that he was knowledgeable about horse racing. So they proceeded in front of me to reenact the entire Kentucky Derby, which I thought was pretty impressive. And she was incredibly animated, eyes dancing, smiling. And I thought, this is a different person from the kind of inscrutable public persona. So in her case, I wanted to get behind that inscrutable public persona and really show what she is like as a human being. as a wife, as a daughter, as a sister, as a parent, as a friend. And that was my quest. In the case of Prince Charles, he's led a much more public and kind of sprawling life. So I really had to kind of get my arms around his life and really try and analyze it and show the panorama of his interests and the influences on him, both events, some of them tragic, in the case of his marriage to Diana, which was, as he described in the letter to one of his friends, 11 years of hell, which is a pretty strong thing to say. But getting back to your original question, I think, you know, when I wrote the book about Princess Diana, it was fair, if not even sympathetic to Charles, because although it was a total mismatch, he did make an effort to make that marriage work at the beginning. And they were just so ill-suited to each other that it just simply wasn't going to work out. And I was so I was honest about it and fair, I think. And as I learned later, that went down very well in Buckingham Palace. I mean, I then thought, oh, I'll never write another book about the royal family. And I went in and I wrote a biography of, dual biography of the Kennedys and a dual biography of the Clintons. And then the head of Random House asked me to write about the Queen. And it took me about a fraction of a second to say yes. And so I went back to a lot of the people who had helped me for the Diana book. And it was hard to penetrate Buckingham Palace, I have to say. You know, it was not an official book, but I managed to secure about as much cooperation as anybody can who is recognized as a serious biographer and historian. And so I was able to travel with her and see her in action. And I also was lucky to go to some social occasions and see her in a more relaxed setting, and talked to not only the Buckingham Palace officials introduced me to, but also a lot of people I met on my own, again, through my friends. It's always like a daisy chain. If somebody trusts you, and they will vouch for you to the next person who will vouch for you to the next person. So in that way, I was able to talk to some of her, really her closest friends, people who've known her since childhood. And then that book was received quite well. I mean, one never hears from Her Majesty herself, but right, from people around her, it was something that they were, you know, they were pleased with. I mean, there were obviously probably a few things in there that they didn't like, but it wasn't hagiography, because, you know, one of the things about the Queen is one of the criticisms is that she always put duty before mothering, and as a consequence, her children didn't have terribly affectionate relationships with her, although she loved them very much. So when the book about Charles, I decided I should do that, which in a way I thought it was going to be a sequel, but it turned out to be a kind of parallel life of two generations who were grounded in the same traditions, but they had very different responses to the world around them.
Well, tell me, when you're doing these interviews with these folks who are so close to the royals, do you have to protect their identities as you're writing this book?
Initially, in many cases, I did, to make them, to reassure them, to give them a level of comfort. I would say, we can talk on background. I would like to get as much that's quotable by name as I can, and I'll come back to you and let you know what I'd like to quote and the context. And I would say in about, you know, 80%, maybe 90% of the cases, they allowed that. There were some people who just didn't want to be cited by name. But surprisingly, a number of them did. You know, people who were very close to her, people like her cousin Margaret Rhodes and her cousin Lady Elizabeth Anson and another cousin Lady Mary Clayton and some of Charles's close associates also were able to talk on the record. And that invariably gives a book more power if you have more people as named sources than as anonymous sources.
You're listening to Reader's Corner, and I'm talking with Sally Bedell Smith about her book, Prince Charles, The Passions and Paradoxes of an Improbable Life. Well, one of the things that I'm sure our listeners are thinking about is The Crown. We're all watching The Crown now. And guess I have two questions. One is just how accurate do you – not accurate, but how good of a job do you think the Crown does in portraying the Queen and those around her, but more specifically on Prince Philip? And this gets us to Prince Charles, really, because in your book you point out in his young life he was sent off to a boarding school that was not the choice of the Queen. And in that movie, The Crown, and in your book, you point out that this was not exactly the best time of his life. It was a horrible experience. Perhaps you can elaborate on that for us.
Well, when you and I last spoke, there'd only been one season of The Crown. And by and large, I thought that they did a very good job. You know, it was made easier by the fact that they had some wonderful set pieces to portray lavishly and largely accurately, like the royal wedding and the coronation. And they were just sort of setting the table, I think, with the first season. There were some things in there that I objected to, but they were, for the most part, you know, dramatic license that was fairly anodyne. Some things were way off the mark, but they were sort of under control. But I have to say that in the second season, I've been really, really dismayed. And, I mean, my overall observation as a biographer is that the challenge with portraying history on film is that it is so vivid and so memorable. And in the case of The Crown, the gorgeous production, the meticulous attention to detail, and the superb acting and the clever writing tend to lead viewers to take it all at face value. I mean, I've given a lot of talks since the second season premiered in December, and I'm continually astonished at the number of people who say, well, you know, did that happen with Jackie Kennedy? Did she really have a private audience with the Queen and tell her that the time that she met her previously, she'd been high on amphetamines?
Right.
I mean, it's so preposterous. I mean, there were so many things. I mean, if we had an hour and a half, I could do a forensic dissection of each of the episodes. But, I mean, you mentioned Prince Philip, and I think in season one to begin with, and then more egregiously in season two, he really has traduced Prince Philip. I mean, that whole episode about his tour around the world on Britannia is something that he and the Queen decided that he should do together. During that period of time, there was never any talk about divorce as it's portrayed in The Crown.
Right.
That simply didn't ever happen. I mean, last week I was talking to a very close friend of theirs who is their contemporary, and she said that although neither the Queen nor Prince Philip has seen the series, they have heard about it, and Prince Philip in particular is very hurt. I mean, he is portrayed as a kind of a sullen, glaring, empty-headed playboy. And it's almost bordering on malicious. And, you know, he was a modernist. You know, he taught the Queen how to use a teleprompter. He had all kinds of advanced ideas about conservation and medical education and science. He once said he was the first person to pet a microchip on the head. And he has a lot of dimensions, and also the Queen Mother is really inaccurately portrayed. Again, shown as frowning and disapproving, and, you know, she's a person who spent her whole life smiling, basically.
Right. Well, that's very helpful. For those of us watching it, we can depend on fiction, not fact. There's no doubt about that.
Yeah, I mean, I think obviously there are facts, you know, there are real people, and there are events like the Suez Crisis. Like, she did visit with Nkrumah, but it wasn't to show up Jackie Kennedy. I mean, one thing about the Queen is the last thing she would have felt was jealousy, envy, and an impulse to one-up Jackie with an overseas trip. She's the least ego-free person you can imagine, even with her exalted position. She has always had a kind of a remarkable sense of humility, and Charles has that too. And you know, we haven't even gotten into how.
Right. Well, I have a question.
He's misunderstood.
Yeah, and I have a question about that because it, and it's focused on character building, I guess. The first part of it was really that bit about his being in a boarding school that was just a horrible, horrible experience growing up. And you can comment on that. But the second part of it, which I found so interesting, and it suggests that perhaps the relationship with his father wasn't as strong, because you point out in your book that Lord Lewis Mountbatten, the prince's great uncle, he called him Uncle Dickie, was clearly one of the great influences in Charles' life. And when he was assassinated by the IRA in 1979, Charles gave a pretty tough and bitter eulogy. But then, and this is what I found fascinating, toward the end of your book, you talk about a trip that Camilla and Charles make back to Ireland, and he is a very different man, and he gives this eloquent speech. You can take it from there.
Yes, and he was, over the years, as was the Queen. I mean, the Queen was a very important force behind the scenes in trying to promote peace, you know, with Northern Ireland, and he was too, quietly. And obviously the death of Dickie Mountbatten, who was close not only to Charles, but to the Queen and Prince Philip, was a shattering experience. And he was very bitter at the beginning. But one of the hallmarks of his life and his role as Prince of Wales has been an effort to heal and mend the kind of tears in society. And he decided that it wasn't doing anybody good to perpetuate bitterness. And that visit to the site of Dickie's assassination was really important. And the speech he gave was one of healing and reconciliation and forgiveness. And that's very much in character. And getting back to Gordonston, he obviously was miserable at Gordonston. I mean, they took quite a few dramatic liberties. His boarding school in the northeastern part of Scotland is one of the Queen said it was the back of beyond, and it was a brutal place at the time. And but on the other hand, and he was bullied, and he was, you know, a classmate of his said he watched him on the rugby pitch, and he was constantly being hit, and he just stoically refused to hit back, and he was beaten in the dormitory. So it was a terrible experience, and he wrote, you know, letters home pleading, get me out of here. And at one moment, the Queen even contemplated doing that. But Prince Philip, who had been extremely successful there, and his experience there was not as it was depicted in The Crown. He was the alpha male leader from day one, and did not misbehave and lead to the death of his sister. That was a real malicious fabrication. But for Prince Charles, the important thing for him, I think, is that the school had a real emphasis on community service. And that is something that he carried forward in his role as Prince of Wales in helping underprivileged kids, for example, with the Prince's Trust, which to this day he set up in 1976, and more than 40 years later has helped over a million young people learn skills, find employment. People like Idris Elba, you know, one of the stars of The Wire, got his start with a grant from the Prince's Trust to go to acting school. And there are tens of thousands of similar examples, kids who started software companies and then became big successes. As one of his friends said, that the Gordonston experience sort of put some grit in his oyster, and his father sent him because he was so sensitive and he wanted to toughen him up. And he did succeed in toughening him up.
And I don't want to take a thing away from what he's done, but did Diana play a role in spurring on his volunteer and charity work during the years they were married?
No, not in the sense that she influenced him. I think during that time, he really came into his own And I think it was mainly because he was so determined. You know, she was, in a way, she was subverting, trying to subvert him. And that's when he became, you know, maybe partly in an effort to kind of, you know, detract attention from her, but also because it was heartfelt. But he became a, you know, a passionate evangelist on the subject of climate change. He, you know, he attacked the modern, you know, the contemporary architecture establishment for failing to consider the needs of individuals. He went against the health establishment for not considering the whole patient. I mean, he was out front on a lot of very crucial issues. So I think it was during that time of personal misery that he really found his voice as Prince of Wales.
I'm Bob Kustra, host of Reader's Corner, and my guest is Sally Bedell Smith, author of Prince Charles, The Passions and Paradoxes of an Improbable Life. Well, it's amazing to think of his assuming the crown because, of course, he's been waiting almost his entire adult life to do so, and the Queen made a sacred vow when she took the crown that she'd serve her entire life, and I guess she means it since she's going to be 92 this April.
Yeah.
And, of course, there are those who say she should step aside. But here's a guy, Prince Charles, who's been upstaged most of his life during his years with Diana and even his own children, William and Harry. And I wonder if you could comment on the succession issue regarding William, because apparently there's been some talk of, well, Charles has waited too long and they might as well just hand this off to William. I don't even know how that happens or if it can happen.
The short answer is there's no mechanism for that. I mean, when Edward VIII decided to abdicate, they had to pass a law in Parliament, and also it had to be passed by every single one of the, I don't know how many realms there were at the time, but there are 16 realms now that have the British monarch as their head of state, places like Antigua and Jamaica and Canada and New Zealand and Australia, and they would all have to concur. And I think the fear is that any time you inject instability into the line of succession, which has been in place for 1,000 years, you create danger. I think that in a way, it's been to Charles's advantage, although it's been frustrating at times, for him to have had this long wait, because during that time, he's been able to turn what was previously a non-role. Prince of Wales, they were mostly known for drinking and whoring and gambling and just being sort of layabouts. And he's created a real job in which he has used his resources to launch initiatives. He's used his convening power. I mean, there were a few months ago that he got together all the manufacturers of chocolate, and they came to St. James's Palace, and there was a whole presentation about farming cocoa in a more sustainable way. And he was able to get them to talk about it and agree on a set of principles. Now, whether they carry them out or not is another matter, but that's the kind of thing, certainly, that he could do as a king, but he has been able to do repeatedly as Prince of Wales.
Well, the royal family can rest assured that if they had a tea party in Britain, there might be a different story here, given the fact that the royals blow through hundreds of millions of dollars. And I know every now and then I see something where somebody in Britain is raising the issue of why we need a monarchy that's so expensive. Yeah. These folks are living high on the hog. That's a term my mother used to use, but it sounds like a British term to me. In any event, I guess the question is this. You talk about how in recent years he's been given more official functions, Prince Charles, that is. Do we have any clues to how he would handle the monarchy as king, given the fact that, hey, this is a changing world and it's a changing Britain, and maybe the days when people in the parliament were able to tolerate the expenses of the royal family, they were fine then, but are they going to be that way into the future? And will he perhaps tone down the royals a bit when it comes to the funding of this very expensive operation?
Yeah, I mean, there's been a lot of speculation that he would that he would, for example, not use Buckingham Palace as a residence, that he would turn it into, you know, it would obviously, Buckingham Palace is really mostly an office building, and that he would, you know, perhaps even stay where he is now at Clarence House, a smaller place down the road, and Windsor Castle, which is where the Queen loves to be more than anything, that he could conceivably take Balmoral, which is their private residence up in Scotland, and turn it over to the Scottish government. None of this has been confirmed, but I think he wants to have a slimmed down monarchy, but I'm not sure if that necessarily means that they would do away with the footmen and the elaborate state dinners. I mean, they have this incredible setting, which everybody loves to be celebrated in, who has an opportunity to. Every head of state wants to be, you know, entertained at a state dinner. And people love the pomp and the panoply and watching the carriages go by at the state opening of Parliament and the trooping of the color. And it's just kind of ingrained in English society. And I think, well, they'd lose a lot of tourists, for one thing, but I think it's just part and parcel of their identity.
So William and Harry are clearly devoted to the legacy of their mother, Diana, and yet it seems like the relationship they have with their father is pretty strong, pretty healthy.
It is.
And I think that, doesn't that say something about Prince Charles a bit? I mean, this is obviously, those 11 years you're referring to are not his favorite. And he comes out of that apparently as a father who learned perhaps from his own relationship with his own father, which probably wasn't very good. Sounds like he's a man who's managed to rescue his character in this case and do well by his sons.
I agree. I mean, I think it was very difficult for him when he was married to Diana, not least because she cooperated in that very destructive book that was published in 1992 by Andrew Morton, which was her quote-unquote true story that she initially lied about and said she had nothing to do with, and then, of course, she had everything to do with it. But in it, it was said that Charles was a bad father and a selfish father, which wasn't true. And after her death, he really, one of his goals was to prove to the world that he was, in fact, a good and devoted and loving father. And unlike his own father, he's really... he's been a parent with a light touch, a loving touch, but he allowed William and Harry to choose their own schools, to decide to go into the army rather than the navy, which was the royal family tradition, to choose their own advisors, including the really wise and wonderful Sir David Manning, who had been British ambassador to the United States. And when he retired, it was the Queen's idea, actually, that he be appointed senior advisor to William and Harry. And when the idea came up, he said, "I won't do it unless they want me." And it was entirely their call. I don't even think he met with Prince Charles. And he said, "I'll only work for you as long as you want me to." And he's still working for them today. And so they appreciate his wisdom. And Charles, to his credit, has moved out of the way and let them carve out their roles, choose their advisors, and live their lives, you know, obviously within the bounds of what's expected of the royal family, but also kind of according to their own lights.
Well, Sally, we've run out of time, but we didn't run out of enough time anyway to go out and get a copy of this book and pick it up and read the rest, over 500 pages of Prince Charles' life and his relationships with the world, with the royal family, with the people of Great Britain. And it's really, you've done a fine job of recounting this man's life. And of course, there's some really interesting things yet to come in the second edition to this, which you may or may not write, but it's going to happen one way or the other. The name of the book is Prince Charles, The Passions and Paradoxes of an Improbable Life by Sally Bedell Smith. Thank you so much for joining us today at Reader's Corner.
Thanks, Bob. I much enjoyed it.
Next week, Scott Anderson, author of Fractured Lands, How the Arab World Came Apart. Reader's Corner is presented by Boise State Public Radio. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones. Research by Anna Webb. Our producer is Janelle Brown. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner. You can find out what's coming up next on Reader's Corner or sign up for our free email podcast on our website. That's BoiseStatePublicRadio.org.